All right, this is Gary Parrish again from CBS Sports again. It's now Tuesday, September 1st, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. We haven't recorded one of these in a while because there really hasn't been much to talk about in the world of college basketball, but I'm bored. And Sam Bassini just got back from Australia, and so I got him and Matt Norlander to join me this afternoon. And I guess we'll start at Indiana, where a third player has now been dismissed from the program since the end of last season. The latest is Emmett Holt, the role player at best, who was cited for illegal possession of alcohol a couple of weekends ago. It was the second time he had been involved in an alcohol-related arrest in the past 10 months. He's only 19 years old, so now he's gone. And as I wrote, he really left Indiana with no choice but to dismiss him because they are battling a PR situation here, a larger narrative that suggests players within the program cannot stop, for whatever reason, doing dumb and illegal things. To be clear, it is just basically dumb little college kid things. We're not talking about, you know, domestic violence, and we're not talking about rape allegations. It's underage drinking and smoking in a dorm room or whatever. So, Norlander, I want to start with you by asking, is Indiana now some off-the-rails program constantly having to remove players, or could you reasonably argue, hey, we're just talking about weed and vodka here, no sexual assaults, no domestic violence. It's unfortunate, but it's not like they kept a player facing a rape trial on scholarship. We're not talking about Baylor football here. Where do you come down on all of this?
Well, it's good to talk to you guys. It is interesting. You know, we get to the off season and we have a major program. It seems every season in college basketball, you know, one or two of the five or six biggest programs have something major that's happening. With Indiana, yeah, it is not exactly the timing Tom Crean could ever want. He, you know, Tom Crean is always going through something. They had like a 5 month period where the program was good, basically from Watford hitting the shot, and that brief honeymoon period, and then up until they lost to Syracuse in the tournament. Those were the only real good days for Crean at Indiana. This is relatively minor. I don't think too much of it, honestly. But listen, it's a bad look when the president, Indiana's president, spoke out very forcefully in terms of, you know, university leadership when it comes to this kind of stuff. You don't often see chancellors or presidents come and speak out about these kind of issues, especially if they're at this sort of level. But it's enough where he's embarrassed by the program, and Crean had no choice. I mean, Holt did it to himself. It's not a three strike, it's a two strike and you're out kind of situation. Holt is by no means and was by no means a key figure on the roster, but when you're a player that's not of, you know, considerable talent, relatively speaking, you leave the coach no other choice. Crean is in a really delicate spot here. We all know that. Indiana should be a tournament team forthcoming, and a lot of that has to do with a five-star player named Thomas Bryant, who was also part of that citation along with Holt, but this is Bryant's first run-in with the police, and let's make no mistake about it, he is a much better player than Holt was. So Bryant only goes through internal discipline for now. But it, you can't have much more of these. You know, remember last year when all this stuff kind of bubbled up and you had Holt hitting Devin Davis, you know, his former teammate. Devin Davis has also been kicked off of Indiana.
Right.
And he hit him with a car. And actually, the police found Devin Davis at fault, even though Holt was driving and both had been drinking alcohol and Davis suffered head and brain trauma that prevented him from even playing last year. But when a lot of that went down, and we've discussed this on the podcast before, our former colleague Greg Doyle said this should just about be it for Tom Crean. Like, he shouldn't be the coach of this program and yada yada. And I think he's walked some of that back. But it's just something, one thing after another. And Crean's already got enough to deal with here that these incidents just mount up more and more, and he's already got a significant part of the fan base that's not on his side. And so even if Crean can't control what his players are doing, he kind of addressed this in speaking with the media last week, guys, when he said, I take responsibility. He basically, I'm trying to paraphrase what he said, because I watched the video, I watched the press conference. He said something along the lines of, I take responsibility, but I'm not the one choosing those actions that they've done, or something like that. So he's putting it on himself as much as he could rationally do, while still kind of throwing it at his players and saying, we haven't had good leadership in a lot of ways within that locker room, which to me is a little bit of a shot, maybe not a shot, but, you know, he's putting on Yogi and some of the older guys in the locker room, where the program itself is not nearly as tight as it should be given the circumstances surrounding Crean's employment.
If the program doesn't have good leaders among its upperclassmen, and perhaps there's a culture problem there. You know, we always hear about, you know, the culture of the Patriots locker room or the culture of the San Antonio Spurs. Well, it seems reasonable to suggest, if only because like Tom Crean suggested it, that the culture around Indiana basketball right now is not good. That's why players keep doing, again, relatively minor things, but consistently relative to other big time programs, dumb and illegal things. If it is a culture problem, and if it is a upperclassman lacking leadership problem, how much of that, Sam, falls on Tom Crean? Is he responsible for that?
That's a good question. It's a fair question. I just don't know how much of this I personally put on Crean. I mean, yeah, he's bringing these guys into the program. He's, you know, he does take responsibility for, you know, bringing kids in that maybe, as you said in your column, that are knuckleheads, so to speak. So, yeah, he deserves a little bit of blame for that, for bringing kids in. But at the same time, this is none of these situations have been overly awful to me. I mean, Devin Davis getting hit by a car, that was awful, but it wasn't like a problem where you look at Tom Crean and go, oh man, Tom Crean, this was 100% his doing that one of his players got hit because he was drunk and it was his fault. So I don't blame Tom Crean a ton for this. I think that he deserves a little bit, but I think that if he wasn't in a situation where he was on the hot seat because of the on-court product, right, there wouldn't really be an issue here at all.
It just doesn't help a situation whatsoever when you've got a fan base. A lot, not everyone, I feel Indiana as a whole and its fan base have not turned on Crean, but there is a hearty percentage of fans that certainly have, and basically no matter what Crean does outside of maybe getting to a Final Four, could he ever turn back the hands of time or change their minds? And so when you're in that kind of situation, all of these things become compounded, become even more emphasized. And so it really hurts him more than anyone else in the grand scheme, because you've got a certain kind of personality that fans aren't embracing, on top of the fact that you haven't won as much as they think you should have, then yeah, these little things become bigger things. And ultimately it becomes one of his biggest problems.
Let's also note that they do have Final Four potential this year too.
They absolutely
this roster is one of the probably 10 most talented in all of college basketball this year, I think.
Here's what I would say. A couple of things. One, to your point, Norlander, about trying to get the fan base back on board. I talk a lot about this because of where I live and the state of the Memphis basketball program and its fan base and the relationship it currently has with Josh Pastner. And, you know, it is very rare throughout modern history of high major college football or basketball that when a significant portion of the fan base turns on the coach, that coach can actually flip it back around and keep it flipped around for a significant amount of time. In other words, you can delay the inevitable, but once it gets bad, once it gets toxic, once it gets where, as the story goes, people are chanting negative things about you at your son's high school basketball game, like, I don't know how many examples there are in history where that gets turned around. You can put it off. Like, Rick Barnes put it off for a year at Texas. But then the next disappointing year he had, it was his last year at Texas. And I think, you know, on some level, perhaps to different degrees, but on some level, Tom Crean at Indiana finds himself in a similar position to that Josh Pastner finds himself in at Memphis. Like, for whatever reason, whether it's fair or not, dumb or brilliant, a significant portion of the fan base has turned. And I don't know I suppose it's possible, but I don't know that it's probable to ever get that flip back around. And my guess is both of those guys, their next bad year will be their last year at that school. In other words, like Tom, like they go to an Elite Eight this year, like nothing crazy about that. And he'd be fine, obviously. You don't move coaches after an Elite Eight. But if they came back the next year and missed the tournament, that might really be it. And same thing for Josh. Like, Josh could go to a Sweet 16 this year for the first time as a head coach And, you know, he'd obviously keep his job if he wanted to keep his job. But if the next year was, like, miss the, in that, you know, NCAA tournament, that would be it, probably. And so it's just – and I don't even mean this specific to these guys. It's not unique to them at all. It's just sort of a statement about high-major college athletics in general and the social media, talk radio, message board world that we live in. It is – very, very difficult to flip fan bases back in your direction after they've turned on you to the degree that some fans have turned on those two guys. Beyond that, I would say this. I suppose if you wanted to put it on Crean that if the, you know, the cultures are created at the top, and if you have poor leadership that falls on your shoulders a bit, and if you have poor culture within your program, that falls on your shoulders a bit. Like, if somebody wanted to, like, hammer home that point, I can't really intelligently argue against it. But I do think we've reached a point where all he can do is talk to the players. And keep in mind, it's not like he's bringing in known problem guys. You know, like, Emmett Holt clearly has been a knucklehead since he arrived at Indiana. But it wasn't, I mean, in fairness, I didn't know much about Emmett Holt before he got to Indiana. Honestly, still don't know much about him other than he likes to underage drink out in public. But, it wasn't like he would, you know, had a juvenile record. Like, these aren't, you know, bringing in borderline criminal kids and then going, I can't believe they got in trouble. Well, you know, they're just bringing in normal basketball prospects. And for one reason or another, they keep getting into dumb situations. I think we've reached the point where all you can do now is explain to them enough is enough. And no, if you play at Ole Miss, and I only bring Ole Miss up because they had a star player get a DUI this summer. If you play at Ole Miss and you get caught drinking underage, you probably won't be dismissed from the team. But if you do it here, you're going to be now, because this is the situation I would say you guys created, but let's just say we all created. We find ourselves in the same spot now. I cannot tolerate any other stupidity. Right. Because it falls back on me and it reflects poorly on our university and the president's pissed off. Once you make that clear to the players, and I'm told by multiple sources he's made that clear to the players, all you can do when those players then goof up is just dismiss them. And in fact, you could argue, I think reasonably, that Hunter Mascarenhas being dismissed for what he was dismissed for, just like literally just being in a room with weed, like there's no evidence that he was smoking, that it was his. I was actually told when he got to his he actually did pass a drug test after that at Indiana. I mean, that's what I was told. So there's no evidence it was his weed. There's no evidence he was smoking. He was simply in a room with marijuana. Well, like, okay, well, you're gone. And so is Devin Davis. And now Emmett Holt's gone. You could argue, because I've seen some fans arguing, that this is the punishment no longer fits the crime, that Jesus Christ, you can't be dismissing kids over something this small. But the problem becomes you almost have to at Indiana now, because every small thing isn't a small thing anymore. Every small thing is a negative national headline that plays into a larger narrative. And so I find it hard to point a finger at Tom Crean right now, because he's made it clear to his players what the stakes are. And now consistently, each repeat offender we've had since the end of the season has been dismissed from the team. What else is the guy supposed to do? Is that fair, Norlander?
That's fair. See, so yes, and now you're hitting on stuff that I was going to hit on for sure. You know, Crean has addressed the team in basically the most emphatic way you possibly could, and so to a certain degree, if anything were to happen again, you can't look at it as anything but the players basically not respecting their coach and not giving a damn. And if that happens, that's also just another negative hit on Crean. Even if the player or players were to do something, it'd be an awful look for them. It reflects immediately on Crean. I will say, relative, you know, we're recording this podcast and we're now less than a week away from college football starting, and sometimes I see what happens in college football, and I read, we've got a really strong stable of writers at CBS Sports that cover that sport, and I mean, UCLA, relevant program, what, had like a defensive back picked up on a robbery charge this week.
Yes. Yeah, he robbed an Uber driver.
Clemson's kicker is going to miss time, right, because he got arrested this offseason. Like, that's random. Ohio State, the consensus number one team in the country, I think will not have four players for its most critical game of the season, being that it's a road game at Virginia Tech, and that's the one that people think they could lose among all others if they were to ever even lose one. There are It seems
and
like
seriously, Cole... there's like that massive Baylor story too.
Oh yeah, sure. Baylor kept their guy like, facing a rape trial like, on scholarship. How about this? Ole Miss's starting quarterback got arrested earlier this year for telling a bouncer at a club after like you know causing a big scene because he was you know in, heavily intoxicated. Got arrested for telling the bouncer, threatening the bouncer, telling him he was going to go to his car and get his machine gun and come back in and shoot the whole place up.
So this like, is that Jim Kelly's kid?
Jim Kelly's nephew, I believe.
Chad Kelly.
Yeah.
So okay.
it's like relative, and that's the other point I've tried to make consistently with the Indiana stuff. Ain't none of it that big of a deal, independent of everything else. This isn't a, it's not a coke charge. It's not domestic violence. It's not rape allegation. Right. It's not you know academic fraud misconduct. It's just like seriously everything that these Indiana players have done outside of get you know when one of them got caught you know DWI. Who was that? Was that Yogi maybe or no? I don't know what or man. Hunter. It was Hunter, right? What I don't whichever
Yogi
one
got hit with something too.
Yeah. Okay. So outside of a DUI. And like running over one of my friends with a car, everything else they've done, I've done when I was in college. You know, was I ever in a room with weed? Sure. Was I ever underage drinking all the time? So like, it's hard for me to like take some sort of moral stand against what's been going on there. But what they have to understand, and I think Cody Zeller pointed this out, in the same weekend, or perhaps it's just in the first week of school or first 2 weeks of school, that Thomas Bryant and Emmett Holt were cited for underage drinking. Like another 200 students were cited for underage drinking at Indiana. Mm-hmm. It's not fair, I guess, but like that doesn't even, it's part so the beside deal, the though. Point. You have to understand you're held to a different standard. So stop doing stupid shit.
You gotta absolutely, and I brought up the college football stuff. Not to say college basketball isn't without you know it's you
sure.
know, from the Oregon stuff.
Certainly,
you mentioned the academic fraud stuff with UNC. College basketball has had its issues overall, but generally speaking, in this off season, fortunately, the sport has been void of a lot of stuff that. Comparatively speaking, college football has not been and almost never is. So it is, and you know, it's Indiana, it's Crean. There's some inflammatory stuff that can just boil up there. But yeah, we should not. Basically, if we're talking about this in any sort of regard again on the podcast in the next 7-8 months, then it's gonna mean some bad stuff for Crean, unless we're talking about an end of the bench guy and Indiana's heading toward a 3 seed and stuff like that, and then maybe can manage it a little more because winning is obviously a great deodorant, but. Not the situation he needed whatsoever, Crean did.
It'll be interesting to see. Like, this will be the big test study. If Thomas Bryant, because the way they can rationalize, and I think fairly, rationalize keeping him and dismissing him in Holt, is that for Emmett it was a second offense, so to speak, and for for Thomas it was a first. I wonder what would happen if Thomas Bryant gets caught doing something like really, really dumb, but like really, really minor, like with a fake ID or like, you know, with a beer can in his dorm. Like, I wonder if they'd really be willing to pull the trigger on a 5-star prospect, you know, before he plays a game or in the middle of his freshman season for a second minor offense. Because that's what they did do with Emmett Holt. They pulled the trigger on a second very minor offense. That'll be the real test. Would they be willing to do that to Thomas Bryant if a second minor thing came along? You know what? I think they probably would.
The only thing to note with Emmett Holt, though, is the first offense with Emmett Holt got an awful lot of media scrutiny just because he hit Devin Davis.
Oh, of course, but like
it wasn't his fault.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, it wasn't. In fact, like I think police have said this, but I was also told by people connected to that program, like that was on Devin Davis. Emmett Holt had been drinking, but he didn't even test like above the legal limit. He was just underage. So it doesn't matter. So yes, Emmett Holt had been drinking that night, but he wasn't legally, intoxicated. Had he been 21, he wouldn't have been cited at all. But, like, Devin Davis, again, I'm told, was, out of his mind. and like just ran in front of the car. Like there was like I could have been driving that car, you could have been driving that car, Emmett Holt could have been driving that car. We were going to hit Devin Davis that night. So, but the problem becomes is that didn't just reflect poorly on Devin or Emmett. It reflected poorly on the entire because it was such an ugly headline. Yeah. You know, Indiana player runs over other Indiana player. It created this perception with the program, and every little thing that's happened since then is tied back to that. That thing is what caused all of this to be where it is right now, I think.
Yeah, it is. I agree with that.
Let me ask you this then, switching gears, because there ain't much other big news going on in college basketball, but it was a weird story from the weekend. Seton Hall, and Matt Norlander, you wrote about this, had an assistant coach, a guy who was considered an influential figure in New York, which is why he got hired in the first place for recruiting purposes, has resigned because he wants to be a middle school math teacher. Okay, does that make any sense? It just strikes me as the perfect example of there's way more to it. Because who is walking away from being a Division I assistant coach to be a middle school math teacher? Like, seriously, in the history of basketball, who's ever done that?
Right, and that's not to say that being a Division I coach is more fulfilling than being a middle school math teacher, because it kind of depends on the person. But generally speaking, the kind of people that get into D1 coaching are not the people that would find teaching math at a middle school level to be something to be more desirable. It's a really weird story. If it was at a bigger program than Seton Hall, I feel like it would have been a bigger story. But this was one where I was like, I feel compelled to aggregate and write off of this because it's so interesting. So Dwayne Morton, here's the background on the story. And it is, I don't know, I feel like there's an element here that we don't know. But Dwayne Morton said he was going to leave. Now this is, he's a father to a redshirt freshman on the team that didn't play last year. But he coached Isaiah Whitehead and his son at the high school level. And Isaiah Whitehead is a five-star prospect. He honestly is the most important player Kevin Willard has ever landed since getting to Seton Hall. And to a certain degree, Isaiah Whitehead's performance will reflect upon whether Kevin Willard is coaching Seton Hall 1 year from this very podcast. To be honest, frank and honest with you, it means that much. Whitehead's decision to go to Seton Hall was seen as a package deal, a true package deal, which, you know, a lot of times one player goes to one school, another player goes to another school. They're five-star players. That's not a package deal. A package deal means you get me only if you take the lesser player kind of deal. And that's what happened with Whitehead and Morton. Morton also was a prominent figure in Lance Stephenson going to Cincinnati all those years back. So he's not just some Johnny-come-lately. He's been an influential high school basketball coach in addition to being a middle school math teacher. It is bizarre. I'm glad we've at least brought it up and mentioned it on the podcast, because I don't think this has ever happened in the history of college basketball. And now you have a situation where, big picture nationally, it's not a huge deal. Seton Hall's got to find an assistant coach and scramble, whatever. But it's September 1st, and you're a Big East program, and you don't have a full coaching staff. That's kind of a mild calamity, especially when you consider the details behind it. I maintain there's got to be something else tied into why he would leave at this, especially at this stage. Why do you decide right now? And is the money any part of being a factor? I can't imagine that it would be, when, you know, you got to be making less to.
There can't be a scenario where a middle school math teacher makes more money than a Big East assistant coach.
There's just no way. So it is a little interesting. Now, his son is still on the team. Morton's son is on the team, and Whitehead's still part of the program. This is a Seton Hall team that last year started out so hot and absolutely caved. I don't know if any program cratered the way that the Pirates did last year. They can't have a repeat of that. So it is interesting for a program and a coach that are certainly coming to a head this season.
You know, so we concluded our Candid Coaches series, I guess it was last week, and the last question in it was about what are college basketball's best three jobs? In fact, that's what we asked college coaches at all levels. What are college basketball's best three jobs? The answers in order, top three, Kentucky, Duke, and North Carolina. Sam, did you agree with that?
Yes, I would say. I definitely would say that North Carolina is the number one for me.
That's the number one for me, too. And I know Kentucky fans will go crazy about that. But to me, like, North Carolina,
nobody's ever failed at North Carolina.
Just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Like, even Matt Doherty recruited, like, all
you got
of
people
the,
going, oh, Matt Doherty, you want to explain Matt, why that's
well,
not true?
Matt Doherty recruited the team that won the national championship.
Yeah.
My point would be, we've seen
we've seen coaches totally like
Tubby,
fail out
Tubby
of Kentucky.
Look at
Billy Gillespie.
At the end, Tubby couldn't recruit at a high level at Kentucky. Billy Gillespie couldn't recruit at a high level at Kentucky. So the idea that you can't that you just automatically going to get big time players at Kentucky, not true. I just gave you two examples from the past. Whatever it is, 10 years, 12 mm-hmm. years, 14 years that for, you know, that didn't actually do it. There's never been a guy in modern history who hasn't recruited at a high level at North Carolina. You can call Matt Doherty a failure if you want to. That's fine. I would counter it by telling you Matt Doherty was signing five-star guys after five-star guys after five-star guys after five-star guys that ended up helping Roy Williams win a national championship. Doesn't mean Matt could have won it with them, but it does mean he got those players on campus. And so when we have, you know, decade after decade after decade of proof that that you can remain a nationally relevant program and almost regardless of the head coach, you can sign five-star guys consistently, like, to me, that's the best program in America.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. As far as Duke being in the top three, I don't know whether or not I buy that, just because there are a lot of things that go into Duke being in the upper echelon of college basketball, and most of them are Coach K related. I mean, let's not mistake it. It's still a great job within the grand scheme, but if that job opened right now, would you really want to follow Coach K?
I mean, if they're going to pay me $9 million a year, I would.
Well, yeah, but they're not going to pay you $9 million.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, I'd say this. It's not the job you turn down, but it might be the job that you wish you would have about 3 years into it when you realize you're not Coach K. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it's just one of those jobs where you don't know. I don't think we know how good of a job that actually is, because it's inseparable from the Coach K brand.
I would agree. So I would not have Duke as a top three job. It's a little bit like – I wouldn't say they're parallel by any means, because Calhoun made UConn, and Duke certainly had a reputation before Krzyzewski got there. But whereas Duke might have been considered, you know – top 30 program all time at the time Krzyzewski got there, UConn was absolutely nothing before Calhoun. But it's like, what will Duke be without K, as opposed to, you know, what Calhoun and UConn have been since those two parted ways? I would say Carolina is the best job in the country. I would go Kentucky 2, and I would go Kansas 3 when you consider the coaching that's been done there. It's got ties that date back to the inventor of basketball. Right. Okay, so to me, Kansas is a clear 3. I would go Probably Duke 4, I guess. But here's the deal. So when we did this poll,
let me say this about Kansas. This is the crazy thing about Kansas. I'd probably have it a top three job. I think my top three would be Carolina, Kentucky, Kansas. Like, maybe
that would be my order.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's what's wild about Kansas. They've literally had nothing but Hall of Fame coaches since 1983.
Yes.
For more than 30 years, Larry Brown, followed by Roy Williams, followed by Bill Self. Larry and Roy are already in the Naismith Hall of Fame. I think everybody assumes Bill Self is going to be in the Naismith Hall of Fame someday.
Yeah.
Okay, easy. Like, it's a shoe-in. So, like, how is that even possible to have nothing but Naismith Hall of Fame? For people who don't understand context, there's only six active coaches in college basketball right now who are in the Naismith Hall of Fame. It's Krzyzewski, Roy Williams, Larry Brown, Jim Boeheim, Rick Pitino, and John Calipari. That's it. Okay? So there's six. And Kansas has gone more than 30 years without ever having a Naismith Hall of Famer as its coach. That's incredible.
It's absolutely nuts. Now, those were the top four, by the way. It's for context, so here were the schools that got multiple votes. Kentucky, Duke, Carolina, Kansas. First of all, it's Kentucky by a mile that was the number one job. Then there was some separation. Then Duke was clearly the second. And then some separation again, and then Carolina and Kansas were really close. And then you could draw a firm line. And then you got into Texas, UCLA, Arizona, then Indiana. A lot of guys did not say Indiana, which was a little surprising to me. Draw a little bit of a line. And then I had three coaches tell me Stanford was the best job, their number one job in the country, because of the academic. It was the best blend of location, state, in-state talent. You get the best combination of reliable student athletes and really good basketball players. Listen, I don't agree with it.
No, that's the dumbest answer.
And the three coaches that told me, by the way, are not connected. Like, they don't have ties to Stanford. They don't run in the same circles. These are three separate coaches. When the first one I got, I was like, all right, well, here's a random one for Stanford. And then I got two more. which surprised, like, I don't think I'd consider Stanford a top three job in the Pac-12.
No, it's not. Arizona, UCLA, Oregon, all better.
Washington, you could argue, is also better.
And
in Seattle.
Yeah, no, I think you
with
could.
With that fan support.
Arizona, UCLA, Oregon, Washington.
Then
you could argue Utah's better.
You
could. I don't know that I would, but I mean, you could try it.
I had a couple people tell me Stanford, too, just being out on the West Coast. And another thing that they mentioned is like the stability in the athletic department. Like, you can feel reasonably confident you're going to be there for 5 years.
Which means something to coaches, for sure. Gonzaga, yeah. Louisville, and Florida were the other ones that got votes. But, you know, there are a lot of schools didn't get one vote. UConn didn't get any vote. And this wasn't surprising to me, but for listeners that might be expecting it, you know, Syracuse, Georgetown, UConn didn't get any votes. Who else? It's been Michigan State didn't get any votes. I don't think Michigan got any votes. So there are a lot of good programs that aren't, you know, I don't know if Maryland might have gotten one.
I think
Ohio State's not on this list.
Ohio State, that's a great point. Yeah. That's a huge shocker. Ohio State, from the guys I pulled, they didn't get one vote as a top three job, which you can, if you really, you could make an easier case to me that Ohio State is a number one overall job than like a Stanford. And yet I didn't have one person tell me Ohio State.
Yeah, I couldn't believe Ohio State didn't get any votes, like none. Nobody listed at top three with you, me, or Sam. The Stanford thing's just bananas. I'll never understand that.
Gonzaga's weird too.
I actually don't. I think you can make a case Gonzaga.
I had one person almost give me Wichita State for the same reason they gave me Gonzaga, which, you know, it's kind of what Marshall's made it. But Wichita State and like Gonzaga, if you really want to run the league and get a lot of financial support and stability, like you can. But yeah.
Yeah, I think like Gonzaga is still probably more of a brand at this point than Wichita State is.
Yeah.
But like Mark Few's making millions of dollars, beautiful on-campus facility, great fan base, no pressure because you're going to win the league every year almost by default just because your school has invested in that program to an extent. You travel first class, you're able to play in these big neutral site events. I think you can easily, and you're set up to go to the tournament every year because you're so far and away.
I think
better.
You can make the argument, and I've talked to Gonzaga fans over the years, and I've talked to Mark about this. I think you can make the argument that actually Gonzaga has more pressure nationally from its non-fans to do well in the tournament than it does from its own fans to win a league or show well in the tournament. They're just kind of,
I think that's fair.
They're kind of, you know, but open spirit, basketball loving. They enjoy it, but they don't live and die with it. It is truly one of the most comfortable, quote, big time jobs in the sport.
It's similar to the way Memphis was in Conference USA. It's changed now because they're in a league with Cincinnati, with Connecticut, with some like-minded basketball programs, if that even makes sense. But before, when it was just they could outspend everybody, out-facility everybody, out-travel everybody, and they were enough of a national brand because of John Calipari. Like that, the difference between Memphis and Gonzaga was that at Gonzaga the fans were a little more laid back, and at Memphis there's nothing laid back about anything. But Memphis in Conference USA was a lot like Gonzaga in the West Coast Conference, just far and away better than everybody else because of the resources the school provided. Again, it's different now, but I actually can make an easy case that Gonzaga is one of the best jobs. And I think Indiana probably should be a little bit higher. Like, Indiana's a great job. It just is. It might not feel that way to Tom Crean right now, but that's one of the top 5 to 10 jobs in America, easy.
Yeah, and I'll say this too. More coaches mention fan support as a real reason for a program being a top program than I expected, at least. Like, I thought that there'd be like security or money or facilities or you can get big time recruits easier. But like, a lot of coaches were just straight up like, hey, like, this program has the best fan support. Like, that's why they mentioned for Kentucky every time.
You know why? Because I would think is because, like, most of these guys know how difficult it is to get anybody to care about college basketball. It's just like, you know, it is incredibly important at Kentucky, at Kansas, at Duke, at Carolina, at Indiana. It's important at Memphis. It's important at Gonzaga. It's important in Wichita. But how
Syracuse, UConn, like, yeah, there are certain spots, but yeah, you're on the right track.
Yeah, by and large, like, it's hard to get people to care. Like, you know, even when you're good, Like, Ohio State's good every year. Sam, you know better than you. How do people really care? I mean, like, care. Like, it affects their mood.
Not really.
Right.
Not, like, on the grand scale.
Right. That's what I mean. Like, it's hard.
I mean, certain people, like, there's a strong, very vocal part of the fan base that cares.
Right.
But it's not, like, a massive thing either.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, by and large, most coaches, it matters at Maryland. That's another one. Like, I don't want to leave people out. But most coaches of even top 60 programs in America know how difficult it is to get the fans to care. It's probably why it resonates with them that it seems awesome from a distance when they see a fan base like completely emotionally invested. Mm-hmm. Last thing I want to touch on before we get out of here was another question in our Candid Coaches series. And it was one where we asked college coaches if they thought a female assistant would be hired into Division I basketball at the next, you know, in the next 3 years. And I don't think it's a surprise to any of us that most said no. And I actually think some of the reasons are actually valid. One, you know, would a woman be effective recruiting 16, 17-year-old boys? I don't know, but like I'm willing to acknowledge I don't know the answer to that. It could possibly be a hurdle. The other one that I think resonates is, hey, you know, a lot of coaches said this. I don't know. Who would I even hire? You tell me. You know, like, I don't know who women, you know, coaches are. Like, I know the candidates that I might look at for men because this is the business I'm in. But, like, you tell me. Who would I even hire? And honestly, if somebody asked me that question, every once in a while I'll get asked by a coach, hey, who are the best five assistant coaches under 35? If you were hiring somebody, give me some names. And then I'll get this one. Give me the five best minority assistant coaches in the country. If you were going to hire a minority, who would it be? And I have answers for all of these things. Like every March, April, I have these conversations with coaches. If they were to ask me right now, hey, if you were going to hire a female, who would you hire? I have no idea. I totally get, at least that resonated with me. Then we had some answers that some of our friends who are women in sports media who cover college basketball found sexist, and I can understand why. Here is one quote. Quote, I think it's too dangerous. I do not like any disrespectful language at any point, and there are times in basketball that guys can use profanity. It would be even more unacceptable in front of a female. I would be too sensitive about it. You just never know. A guy says something, she can accuse you of sexual harassment. It could put her in an awkward position. End quote. To that, I would say, the only reason somebody could, I guess they could falsely accuse you, but the only reason somebody could actually accuse you, correctly accuse you of sexual harassment is if you were sexually harassing them. So like, don't be an animal and you'll probably be okay in that regard. And, another coach said, I quote, I would have a hard time being myself daily.
The coach that told me that, I was shocked by the coach that told me that.
Like, I'm not shocked.
Knowing who that coach is. Yeah. I'm like, really, man? Like,
well, I'm not shocked to hear that because I, you know, it's a little bit like you hear, what about a woman in the locker room? What if she'd be staring at her ding-a-lings? You know, like,
I mean, there were coaches that said these things.
Oh, I know. But like, it is like, what do you mean you can't be yourself? Like, I walk into a radio studio every day where I don't work directly with, unless you count advertising people, then I guess I do work directly with women. But like, I don't feel like I can't be myself. I just can't be an animal. So like, it's just a weird thing to hear grown men say, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. This was, I proposed this when we were kind of debating on what questions to go with, and I felt that we would get interesting responses, and the response, there were even a few that I wasn't comfortable putting in the post, and I'm not even comfortable bringing up on the podcast. They were almost like, no, this is beyond off the record. I don't even want this in ink because I'm uncomfortable even, you know, having it out there. But I was first of all, I will say, talked to plenty of coaches that were very open-minded, very forward-thinking, very respectful. And a few of them said, no, I'm basically ready to do it. I just got to find a candidate. And they were believable in those responses. So 75% they said they could not see themselves sharing a bench with a female assistant in 3 years. 25% said yes, that they could. But of the 75% who said no, there was certainly a decent majority whose reasons, frankly, are knuckle-dragging. I mean, some of the recruiting thing I can kind of get, but other coaches were like, no, man, I think a female, And some of it is crass, by the way, but some of them know, especially they're like, if I have a hot female assistant, I think that's only going to help me. Like, it is. And this is how coaches will think, because, you know, I wrote this post, and as I said, when it comes to recruiting, every possible weird, slimy, random avenue that mm-hmm. you think a coach might take, trust me, they've already deliberated doing that, if not having done it already in general. The other aspect of this is I did want to specifically ask coaches if they could do it, because I think if we had asked, can you see a female assistant in 3 years? I think it would have been flipped. I think 75% would have said yes. But when you put the onus on the coaches and have them say, no, I'm asking you specifically, they're not nearly as willing to commit. One question I wanted to post to you guys, I guess I'll go with Sam, is this felt like an issue to bring up in light of Becky Hammon clearly seems to be on her way to getting an NBA head coaching job. She seems to be on the right path there. Nancy Lieberman is now with the Kings. For college basketball, kind of broad here, but is this an important issue? I think it's an intriguing issue. I think the sport could probably be benefited by having women in it. But when we did this was, I don't know how big or important of an issue it was. How would you guys quantify that?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say that I can see people saying it's important. It's not super important to me particularly. I understand the reason why you would think it is, but I mean, I don't know. It's hard for me to say. I would say it'd be nice to see a woman on a staff. I think the game would benefit from it, but I don't think that benefit would be like overly incredible either. Like, I think it would just be like, hey, this is a great thing that this woman is on the staff, and that I'm sure that she's doing a great job, and it's a barrier breaking moment, but I don't know that it
and
would
by the way,
revolutionize the game either.
I neglected to put this in the story, and I knew it, but I just, whatever. Patino did do this at Kentucky like two decades back. So this has happened in the sport before, but to my knowledge, not since. So it has happened, but since Patino did it with Kentucky again, it hasn't happened again, and that, you know, that element is a little surprising.
The guy who should do it mm-hmm. is John Calipari, because A, he likes to be the first. He likes to be the innovative first to do all this stuff. And then secondly, you'd be set up to succeed. You know, like
sure.
who couldn't recruit for John Calipari at Kentucky?
It's like with the Spurs too. Like,
yes,
Becky
same
Hammon is set up to succeed.
So like if I it would be cool to see John Calipari do it, because A, I think it'd be obviously positive public relations for him, which mm-hmm. he enjoys, and it would work because John could hire anybody. Like, I think John could hire me to be his, you know, third assistant, and suddenly I'd be one of the hottest assistants in America signing five-star recruits.
To this. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, so like it should, like the guy who should do it is John Calipari. I guess I would say this. I would echo a little bit what Sam said. You know, when I start thinking about the biggest issues facing college athletics, like the lack of women coaching men in basketball doesn't strike me as something that's long overdue. It might be overdue, but it doesn't strike me as like some great injustice, or I don't know. It just doesn't strike me as anything like.
The reason I propose is because a lot of people could come right back at us and say, "Hey, listen, women's basketball has so many men coaches,
sure.
so why can't we have both? You know, have this happening in both aisles here?" And I think there is legitimacy to that kind of response. Plus, sports in general play such an important social role with social issues by setting example just by pure nature of them being, you know, public enterprises and businesses, so to speak. So I think there is something there. I'm a little surprised we haven't hit this point yet. I do think it's coming. You know, a lot of staffs, not a lot, but there are staffs. Colorado State has a female Dobo director of basketball operations. Doesn't Kansas have a female
strength coach?
Yeah. So, you know, they're there. They're getting close, but if I had to predict, I think within five years, I think we will have at least five D1 programs. They might not be the biggest ones, but I think we will see women on benches. I think we're just, it's going to hit a point, and then it's going to, you know, sort of be a tipping point in that kind of regard.
Say no to that. By the way,
you think
I don't think there will be five. There might. I would say like one, maybe two.
2020.
Okay. There will be five.
I think we will. I think we'll see a flurry of them.
The extent that it is an issue, I think it would only be an issue in a larger sense, because we as a country are slowly but surely getting to a point where all of these barriers are broken down. You know, like yeah. whether it's men, women, or gay, straight. Once upon a time you had to have be a certain way to get married. Now that's
Look how fast. By the way, if all you look, stuff, if right. you look at the statistics yeah. of where gay marriage was in 2005 compared to 2015. Mm-hmm. It is a light year jump.
Right.
Light year. So I feel like with each passing year in this country, when it comes to these major social issues, progress happens fast and swiftly. So that's why I say
yeah.
that.
Well, like we might be, a year and a half away or a year and a few months. We might be close to having a woman president, So like I just think to the extent that this is an issue in college basketball, it's an issue because we are, with each year – checking boxes that had never been checked before. Like, have we ever had an African-American president? Well, now we have. Have we ever had a female whatever? Okay, well, then we have. I just think this sort of falls on a much lower and unimportant scale. This sort of falls in line with that.
So here's my thing. The reason that I got most for why women won't be on a bench in the next few years is they just simply don't really have the relationships in the recruiting world, right? Like, and I can't really think of any women off the top of my head either. And it was the same with coaches that, have those relationships in like the AAU grassroots world and the, even maybe in the high school world. But it's just hard to come up with a legitimate candidate right now. And that's why it's hard for me to say there's going to be five by 2020 or something. I hope there are. But
yeah, I think some of that is a little bit of a cop out because it's not like you need all three of your assistants to be massively crazy good recruiters. Usually you have one guy who really, really is kind of, spearheads that along with the coach. And you might have a second. Usually you have a guy that's an assistant that straight up just knows the game. And I think if anything, when women are on a staff, it's going to be because they really understand the game. They know how to coach. They're going to know how to work a whiteboard and a chalkboard, so to speak. And then you just – you incorporate them into the recruiting world. Like it happened. Yeah. Like, listen, the fact of the matter is a lot of these assistants that come in are third assistants at low levels. They don't have jack for connections. Okay. But they slowly work it just like anything else. So to me, if there's a really talented 28-year-old female assistant coach that knows the game well, why can't you incorporate her into that?
Yeah. So, to me, that's the way this ought to go down. You get a somebody who's at a place that's going to, they're going to get players no matter what, John at Kentucky, Bill Self at Kansas, even Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, who Roy at Carolina, or who happens to ever be the head coach at Carolina going forward, I think that guy could get away with simply calling the five best women coaches in college basketball.
This is also my question. Where do they come from? Do they come from the women's college basketball side?
You call
or do they come from like the AAU kind of world?
Yeah, well, no, here's what I would do. If I were trying to be the first guy to do this, I would call – I'd call Gino and honestly, I don't even know, whoever the other five best or women's basketball coaches in America. And I would say, tell me the brightest minds. I want to know the five brightest basketball minds among women that exist in this country. Give me the names. And I would figure out, okay, and like surely, like, if you ask Gino Auriemma and five other dudes or women in women's college basketball, they'd have answers for that. They like just because men's college basketball coaches don't know who the bright women assistants are, or I don't know who the bright women assistants are, it doesn't mean that they wouldn't know. They would know.
Oh, I'm sure they would.
Right. So you ask them, give me the names. And then you just say, all right, brightest basketball mind for a woman in college basketball. The consensus is this woman. I'm putting her on my staff. That's the way you do it.
I agree.
I think that's the smartest way to do it.
Yeah. That's the way you do it. And you know what? You could even, because the salaries are probably so drastically different, you could probably go hire one of the top women's head coaches in college basketball, from the women's side.
Like, especially if you're at a top 15 program.
Yeah.
And without question, a top five program.
Yeah, when you're paying $350,000, $400,000, $500,000. Like, Kenny Payne's making like what, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 a year right now? Yeah. So like, so if you've got that kind of money to throw around, you can go pluck like a lot of people. To me, if it does, I don't have any idea when it'll go down, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. But when it goes down, that's the way it should go down. It shouldn't be Georgia State hiring a woman. I mean, I'd be happy if they did. But if you really want to make it work and make it, it should be one of the premier programs in the country, coached by one of the premier men in the country, who mm-hmm. understands that this might not work somewhere else, but it'll work here because everything works here.
Because, and you know, I would be happy for it to happen at Georgia State or at Kennesaw sure. State or wherever. But the moment where I think that we are going to see the breaking point is whenever, like you say, it happens at a Kentucky or Kansas.
As we, and to
whatever.
Kind of close it up, the way that San Antonio was the one to do it.
Yeah, same thing.
Perfect yep. NBA franchise to do it. You'd really want a blue blood to have the perfect scenario there. Right. All right, so we basically have one more month of the doldrums here of offseason, right, GP? And then October comes, and that's preseason preview stuff. So what are we thinking podcasts going forward? Give listeners an idea.
I don't know. We could do, like, as long as kids keep drinking underage and stuff. We could probably get something done every
– We do have an interesting – I don't want to spoil it.
I mean, seriously, the
means.
Start of college. College kids are just coming back. We're going to get
that is
roll
a huge
of
element,
these.
By the way. You get these 17, 18-year-olds on campus, and listen, it's a very invigorating time. We do have – I won't spoil it for the podcast, but we do have kind of a cool – project mini 1 week thing coming out in about 2 weeks. We could also kind of talk about that after it goes live. That might be interesting.
And I'm going to Maryland next week.
That's right.
I also have no idea what that project is.
That's right. You were on the conference call because you were on the other side of the world, which by the way was random because I'd see you tweet. First of all, you shouldn't have been tweeting period when you were on vacation in Australia. But I see you tweet good morning. It'd be like 3 o'clock in the afternoon here or something like that. Yeah. So
I was releasing draft stuff the entire time I was gone.
Yeah. We could probably, how about this? We'll play it by ear, but I don't see any reason we can't do one a week going forward, right?
Yeah.
If you want to, so, I'm all,
I won't be happy.
Well, keep in mind, we
play
had,
it by ear, though.
We had nothing, and this is sort of the way these things go. We had nothing really to talk about today, and we're at the 52-minute mark. All right? Yeah. So
Hirsch,
like,
you could, that's just the nature of who you are, though, in general, though. I mean, listen, this is what you do. You run a daily radio show in Memphis, okay? And I know that not every single day can you walk into that studio and have Memphis only kind of talk. So you're able to just kind of fill the spaces overall.
It is. For better or worse, that is a true thing you've just said. So anyway, let's get out of here. Remember, you can subscribe to the Iowa College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the latest edition. Make sure you do that. And either way, we will talk to you again, let's say, next week. Till then, take care.